Good afternoon, everybody. It is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Matt Wilson at MIT. He has already lots of great contributions to our neuroscience community. Among them, I'll just point out three big achievements. First, he's the original developer of the neural system simulator, Genesis, under Jim Bauer at Caltech when he was a graduate. Now, Genesis is now version 2.3, as I checked yesterday, using which over 300 papers has been published. Second, when he did a postdoc under Bruce McNaughton at University of Arizona, he developed the quadrupole electrodes called tetrodes for in vivo awake rodent recording with custom-made software called XCrust. And now, together with MCrust, similar version of custom cell clustering software, this tetrode system is now available through Neuralink, and many people are now using. Finally, using this tetrode system, Wilson and McNaughton first reported the reactivation of hippocampal ensemble activity during sleep in 1994. And then with this paper, he was recruited to be a faculty of MIT at Department of Brain and Cognitive Science and PCOA Institute for Learning Memory, and became a full professor in 2004. Since 1994, his research interest is mainly on this functional role of sleep replay in learning and memory. So today's his talk title is Hippocampal Memory Reactivation During Awake and Sleep Status.
We on there? Is that all right? Great, thanks, Kazu. I often get this question about sleep, and oh, you're a sleep guy, you know, you're studying sleep and sleep reactivation. Actually, I'm a memory guy. Memory, learning, and memory. We're at the Institute, you know, PCOA Institute for Learning and Memory. My interest has always been in the question of learning and memory. And the involvement of sleep really came up serendipitously. I won't go into the story when I was a postdoc working in Bruce's lab, but I think what has gone on over the last 10 years in my lab has not been a focused interest on sleep itself, but rather a realization that examination of sleep states, these quiet wakeful states, periods where animals are apparently not doing anything, not actively engaged in behavior, reveal themselves to have perhaps functionally meaningful, but certainly empirically interesting content and structure. There's interesting stuff going on. So I've been drawn to sleep largely because it offers itself as a compelling period during which we have the opportunity to interrogate or examine the content and structure of information within the brain when the animal's not, in fact, engaged in the environment. So it's just a useful paradigm for studying memory. But ultimately, the questions that I am interested in have to do with learning and memory. What is memory? I often put this to my students. I have a class in learning and memory. I ask them to define what is memory. And, of course, the questions, the answers you get back largely reflect a perception of memory as involved in storage. It is about encoding. It is about storage. It is about retrieval. It is the brain's hard drive, a sophisticated way of retaining and accessing information about experience. But we don't necessarily think about whether or not there might be a role for learning in memory. And that is that what we really want to do with experience is not to simply store and retrieve it, but rather to learn from it, to extract from experience regularities, meaningful relationships that we can then use to guide decision making. So the question really becomes, how do we learn from memory? How do we take experience and translate into something meaningful? And so that's where I'm going to introduce the subject of all of the research that I'm going to talk about, and that is the rat and the rat brain, and in particular, the rat hippocampus. So we can see here the rat hippocampus shown in cross-section, the classical lamellar view of the hippocampus. And we take a cross-section showing the primary wiring, input coming in from the entorhinal cortex, going through this trisynaptic loop, making contacts on cells in the dentate gyrus, which then project into pyramidal cells in CA3, CA3 to CA1, CA1 to subiculum, back out to the cortex by the entorhinal cortex. Now, of course, there's a rich history and literature of work on the hippocampus, largely due to its involvement in memory, in the kind of autobiographical or episodic memory that is so compelling in humans, as well as the kind of spatial memory deficits that are observed when you damage the structure in rats. And there's always been I don't know if it's a kind of a species thing, but there's always been a little bit of tension in the study, the memory field, learning and memory field, between the people doing human work and rodent work. And it pretty much comes down to this. Is the function of the hippocampus in the rodent really comparable to the function that it serves in the human? And that is there really any utility in understanding the function of the hippocampus in a rodent if you want to understand that in a human? What's the connection between them? Given that in humans, damage to the hippocampus impairs what we refer to as this episodic memory, the ability to retain experiences or events, autobiographical events. Rodents obviously have a limited capacity to report that kind of thing. They can't tell you, where they went last night, what they had to eat this morning, who they hung out with, a month ago. They can't report these kinds of autobiographical events. And damage to the hippocampus seems to have a profound effect on spatial memory. So you can think spatial memory, rodents, they run around in space, they largely have a rather minimal, complicated, autobiographical, episodic life. Therefore, the hippocampus has adapted itself to specialize in spatial memory in rodents. And in humans, it's evolved to accommodate this more sophisticated kind of learning and memory. Well, I would argue that while that might be the case, there is a link between them. And the functional link between them is that in both cases, spatial memory, navigation, linking together locations in space, episodic memory, linking together events in time, involve the processing of temporal sequential information. And so in thinking about what does the hippocampus do in humans and rodents, we need to think about time, not just space. But since we're working in rodents, we have to deal with space. And here's a picture of a rat, actually alluding to sort of Kazu's history there of my work in this field. This is the first rat that I actually implanted when I was working as a postdoc in Bruce McNaughton's lab. This little handmade device is in fact a microarray, which allows independent manipulation of fine wire microelectrodes or tetrodes such that the tips can be placed into the hippocampus, recording collections of individual cells. This is left into place chronically, so we get long-term recording of the activity of populations of neurons in the hippocampus while the animals engage in normal behavior. In this case, normal behavior is sitting around, sleeping, and running on simple little mazes. Now, why do we have them run on simple little mazes? Well, this comes back to a really seminal observation that was made by John O'Keefe. You could say I wouldn't put him as a grandfather yet, certainly father of the field of hippocampal place cell behavioral electrophysiology. And his observation in 1971 that individual neurons in the hippocampus, in particular in this case the CA1 region, recorded while an animal is moving about in space, exhibit this incredibly compelling behavioral correlate, and that is that they respond, they have spatial receptive fields or place fields, that there are locations in space. In this case, we have a top-down view of a track. This is about 2 meters long. The animal is running from one end of the track to the other, receiving food reward at each end, and in these colored dots represent the action potentials produced by individual hippocampal CA1 neurons. And each dot is an action potential that's placed at the location on the track where it was expressed while the animal was running. So here, and this is accumulated now over about 10 minutes, so as the animal walks along the track, and if you're listening to this yellow neuron, for instance, you'll hear this cell firing, this pop, 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 and then the cell is silent. Whenever the animal goes through this location, the cell will fire. Pop, 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 pop. So it fires in a given location in this place, hence the term place cell. And these fields were termed place fields. Different cells fire different parts of the track. And at any given time, there are, in the rat, on the order of 5 to 10,000 cells that are active. So a given location is being, I won't say represented, but certainly being expressed as a pattern of activity across 5 to 10,000 cells. This pattern changes as the animal moves. And as the animal moves along a path, these cells will fire in a sequence. In this case, yellow, red, green. If you place the animal on a different track, you get different patterns, which may include different cells. If you take the animal off the track and you bring him back the next day, or the next week, or the next month, you can see the same cells firing at the same locations, basically re-expressing the same patterns which correspond to a particular environment, a particular task, in a particular animal. So this is, in a sense, a signature of the animal's experience on the track. Cells, populations of cells, firing in a particular pattern. Now, this was the observation of place cells. But Mayak Mehta, who is a postdoc in the lab, got to thinking about this link, the link between space and time, episodic event memory, sequential memory, and spatial sequential memory. And the question was, how could you actually encode or capture information about time order in the connections within the hippocampus, given that phenomenology that I just showed you? And this is just a little segue here. The overall organization of the talk, what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to convince you that there is a simple biophysical explanation, a mechanism that can explain all of the, sort of intriguing phenomenology, these interesting things the hippocampus does, that there is a simple mechanism that can explain the seemingly complex memory, encoding, retrieval, and function that the hippocampus expresses. And so that's what I'm going to do right now. I'm just going to give you a simple model. So Mayak Mehta, postdoc in the lab, is thinking, how can we capture time? How can we capture information about time order if you have animals that are moving through place fields in a particular order? In this case, yellow, red, green. How could you capture that? Now, one interesting little tidbit of hippocampal place cell phenomenology, and that is when animals move through place fields along tracks like this, the cells not only express a spatial correlate, but also a directional correlate, that this cell will fire when the animal goes through this place in this direction. If it goes to the same location in a different direction, you get differences in firing, or it will fire in one direction, will not fire in the other direction. That is, it's sensitive to both location and direction. So Mayak thought about this. He said, okay, we have place cells activated in a sequence. If you apply a simple temporal, a synaptic rule that also has temporal asymmetry, it might be possible to actually capture that temporal ordering so that this synaptic rule would capture the temporal ordering of firing of these place cells. And so one that he focused on was this phenomenon of spike timing dependent plasticity that's shown here from a paper by Muming Pu, was really first demonstrated by Henry Markram and Bert Sackman, in which they showed that the precise timing of individual presynaptic and postsynaptic spikes could influence both the sign and magnitude of synaptic change. In this case, presynaptic input or spike that arrives just prior to a postsynaptic output produces a significant and robust positive increase in synaptic efficacy. Changing the timing just slightly such that the presynaptic input comes after the postsynaptic output, the acausal direction, input could not have caused the output, leads to a dramatic change in sign and magnitude. Now, connection is weakened. And it was this very sharp transition between positive to negative, given the switch from causal to acausal, which was the most compelling demonstration of this timing dependence. So here you have something, a simple biophysical mechanism that is concerned about time order. So if you take spike time-independent plasticity, you put it into a very simple model of a hippocampal network in which you have ordered inputs. In this case, this is a model loosely, it's a bunch of little balls that I've labeled as CA3, but these represent input into a CA1 cell. And the idea is that as an animal moves in space, let's say from left to right along a track, activating a sequence of input cells, in this case CA3 cells, that also have place fields, that this sequential input into CA1, when passed through this spike timing dependent temporally asymmetric filter, will lead to an asymmetric change in synaptic weights, such that the inputs from these cells, which would represent the pre before the post, animals walking from left to right, these cells get activated before this one, these connections should be strengthened. The inputs here from the cells represented on the right, which would fall into the pre-after-post, input-after-output, should be weakened. And so what it predicts, the simple model with spike time-independent plasticity, predicts that place fields, as shown here in red, as just the expected output, should change from something that is temporally or spatially symmetric. You can't tell whether or not the field is weighted to the left or weighted to the right. Should change to something that is now spatially asymmetric. It should grow this little tail, should shift backward a little bit, and it should do so in a way that depends on the direction of motion. So if the animal is walking through the field this way, it should begin to fire earlier and earlier with experience. And so this is what the simple model predicts, and that, in fact, is the data that Mayank observed. So if you just take a place cell, you look at the firing. In red, you see the activity on the first time through a place field. In blue, you see that after the animal's gone through this, let's say a dozen times, what you see is that the cell will begin to fire earlier. It grows this tail opposite the direction of motion, shifts back, the peak shifts back a little bit, looks somewhat like what you would expect from the model. But Mayank also recognized that hippocampal physiology is not just about firing rates, it's not just about producing spikes, but activity in the hippocampus is modulated by a dominant rhythm known as the theta rhythm. And so here we see, now just looking at activity recorded in the hippocampus over about 10 seconds, and here we see the local field potential, or what would be comparable to the EEG, macroscopic electrical activity in the hippocampus, along with individual unit activity. Each of these rows is the activity of a different hippocampal cell. And so if we're listening to activity in the hippocampus, while you might have one of these place cells, for instance, I have that place cell that's active right there. I'm listening to spikes. I would hear an increase in firing rate, this kind of pop, 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 and then the cell would be silent. Every time I go through there, it fires. But if we listen to a collection of cells, not just one, but let's say 1,000 cells or 100 cells, what we would hear would be a modulated increase and decrease in the overall population output or firing rate that would sound more like this kind of whooshing sound, this kind of. That's going on everywhere. Whenever the animal is moving, this rhythm, the theta rhythm, is expressed. When the animal stops, within about a half a second, the rhythm goes away and is replaced by a different pattern of activity, this aperiodic bursting, that in older literature was referred to as large regular activity, now is commonly referred to as sharp wave ripple activity, but it sounds something like this. So an animal moving, you get theta. Animal stops, you get these sharp wave ripple events. So theta is correlated with locomotion. But John O'Keefe, again, the father of the field, made another observation around 1990 or so, and that is that if you look at the timing of individual spikes with respect to this theta rhythm, first of all, they tend to occur at a particular phase, that is, in this case, in the peak. When the theta rhythm goes up, cells tend to fire. But for individual cells, as the animal moved through the field, the timing of these spikes shifted backward in time. They fired earlier and earlier in phase with respect to this theta rhythm. This one fires at the peak, this one fires a little bit earlier, this one a little bit earlier. Now this phenomenon he termed phase precession. And this is what it looks like. If we take, on average, the animal moving from left to right, we ask when are individual spikes produced with respect to the theta rhythm. When the animal enters the field, they start here late, And they move earlier and earlier as the animal moves through the field. So if you could think of a theta cycle here, we're thinking of spikes being produced. As the animal moves through it, they get earlier and earlier. This pop, 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 fire earlier and earlier. Now, here's a very simple model, biophysical model, that tries to capture this. And if you think of the input to the hippocampus, excitatory input represented here in blue, as something that changes as a function of position. That is, it ramps up, it increases as a function of position. But at the same time, you have time-varying inhibition, shown in red, modulated by this theta rhythm. So you have this 10 hertz variation in inhibition, which is, in fact, what one sees in the hippocampus. The theta rhythm is paced by this periodic fluctuation in inhibition. So you have inhibition fluctuating in red, excitation in blue, and a spike is going to be produced when excitation exceeds inhibition. Simple rule, that's all. This is just the way cells work. You have more excitation than inhibition, you can produce a spike. And so if you ask, when is a spike going to be produced here? For instance, early in the place field, because the excitation is low, you have to wait until inhibition drops all the way to this level before you can produce a spike. But as excitatory drive increases, now you can fire earlier and earlier relative to the peak. You can fire earlier and earlier. So that as you move through the field, the change, spatial change in excitatory input, predicts a comparable change in the relative timing of spikes. So that's it. More excitation, earlier spikes. That's the simple rule. Magnitude to latency. Stronger drive, earlier firing. Now, it just happens if you take that simple rule and you apply it to the actual data that you get from hippocampal place cells, it explains virtually all of the properties that one sees of hippocampal place cells and this phenomenon of phase precession. But the really interesting, in my view, consequence of this phase precession is that it makes predictions about the encoding of time order across multiple cells. So if you think about this phase precession effect, not with just a single cell, but with two place cells, one which has a place field after the other. So I have place cell one here, place cell two over there. So that as I move from left to right, as I walk through these place fields, I'll first activate place cell one and then place cell two. So what I want to do is capture the fact that I've activated cell one and then cell two, encode the time ordering of these locations. Now, we can see what would happen with these two phenomena, and that is this asymmetric excitation that, again, I argued came about as a result of this temporally asymmetric application of this temporally asymmetric spike timing dependent plasticity rule, and this rhythmic modulation and inhibition. So here, the blue cell, note that excitation for place cell 1 will always be larger than the excitation for place cell 2 as I move through these fields. What that means is that place cell 1 will always fire before place cell 2 on each and every one of these theta cycles as the animal moves through these locations. Now, this has two effects. One is that it captures time ordering of these place fields in a biophysically fixed time scale. These cells will fire one after the other over the time scale of 100 milliseconds, and they will do so consistently, independent of what I refer to as behavioral time scale. So a problem that you have in capturing time or time order is that it's variable. How long is it going to take me to walk from here to there? It could be a second, could be a minute, could be an hour, could be a day. There is no fixed behavioral time scale. Stuff happens in the time scale in which it happens. And so having a biological, biophysical substrate for this unpredictable and long behavioral time scale becomes a problem. This mechanism solves both of these problems at the same time. It takes this behavioral time scale and translates it into a fixed biophysical time scale by throwing out time and replacing it with time order. So you could say that's what this system is doing. It's just capturing information about order. Now, if this is what the hippocampus is doing, and that is, it is simply taking the temporally asymmetric properties of NMDA receptor-mediated plasticity, changing synaptic connections in a way that allows them to now capture and express time-ordered activation of these place cells by combining this excitation with time-varying inhibition. So this is what this is the mechanism. This is how the hippocampus captures time order. But if it's capturing time-ordered information, how do you know that it's actually retaining that? And that is, that it has any role in the encoding of information for the purpose of learning and memory. So what sticks? You can see this is what it does, but we don't know that any of this actually sticks. This just could be, you know, empty phenomenology. It just happens to be sort of a curiosity of the timing of spikes in the hippocampus. And as soon as those inputs go away, all of that phenomenology goes away. Now, one argument for studying sleep, as I tried to make early on, is that when we look at the activity of the brain during sleep, any structure that we see, any content, any structure, anything that we see, must necessarily be the consequence of memory, because the stimuli that would otherwise produce that are gone. There's no behavior. There is no outside to drive activity on the inside. So anything we see during sleep must necessarily come as the consequence of this intrinsic structure. We can call it memory. I will simply call it this intrinsic structure. Now, there's the larger behavioral cognitive question, which is, if that activity is present, if memory is present and during sleep, is it meaningful? That is, does it do anything? And, of course, there is the hypothesis. There are a number of hypotheses that confer some functional significance on activity during sleep. Many of them have to do with this notion of long-term memory consolidation. And that is the idea that over time, experience, memory is transformed. It's changed in some way. The simplest view is that that change involves just a relocation. Kind of gets to move out of the, you know, the hippocampal suburbs, and gets to, move up to someplace in the cortex, a nice cortical high-rise down in the city where all the action is. Closer to the action, closer to behavior, closer to the sensory and motor environment. So that there's this relocation of memory from the hippocampus to the neocortex. That's the simple view. A more sophisticated view is that over time, the hippocampus captures information about experience, and then it replays this to the cortex so that the cortex can learn, can examine past experience, and extract from it statistically meaningful, functionally meaningful information. And that is that during sleep, the cortex is basically learning from this archive or repository of past experience that the hippocampus has. And that the nature of that transformation, then, is not simply relocation, but it is reorganization. It's extracting, it's consolidating, it's modifying experience to conform to the needs of the organism to make decisions based upon statistical models of the world. And we can identify different stages of sleep. We can classify them as rapid eye movement sleep, non-rapid eye movement sleep, which is largely slow wave sleep. I'm going to focus on the non-REM, or slow wave, portion of sleep. And during these non-REM periods of sleep, we can look at dominant rhythms that are expressed in the hippocampus and neocortex. And one of them I mentioned, these fast field oscillations, the sharp wave ripple events, which in the neocortex have counterparts that are not identical, but complementary in a sense. So if we're listening to the hippocampus during slow wave sleep, what we'll hear are these irregular burst discharges or ripples. It's kind of ch-ch-ch-ch. So if I'm recording the hippocampus, I hear these discharges, it's quite possible that the animal is actually sleeping. Now, it's not necessary the animal is sleeping, as we'll see later on, because those events also occur during simple quiet wakefulness. If you're sitting here and the animal's getting bored, it's not running around, it's eating, it's engaged in, you could say, non-attentive behaviors, so-called consummatory behaviors, you also get this rhythm. But if I'm listening in the neocortex and I hear something that sounds like this, this is a sleep spindle. It's a 7 to 14 hertz oscillation, lasts about a second or two, and it occurs during a certain stage of slow wave sleep, which you can see here. In humans, this would occur during sort of intermediate stage two, where it's not really light sleep, but you're asleep. You're in slow wave sleep, and now you would start to get these 7 to 14 hertz oscillations, these spindles, which would be expressed across the neocortex. But within the hippocampus, what you would see would be these sharp wave or ripple events. Now, Thanos Siapas, a postdoc in the lab, recording in the rodent prefrontal cortex and hippocampus simultaneously, observed that these two events, neocortical spindles and hippocampal ripples, seem to be correlated. And that is, when you would get a ripple in the hippocampus, it would tend to correlate with the onset of a spindle in the neocortex. So the hippocampus was saying, and the neocortex was, well, I'll loosely say, responding with this, suggesting possibly that during this state, this non-REM slow wave state, that there may be some kind of dialogue, that at least the activity was aligned in a way to accommodate some kind of structured interaction. Now the question is such an interaction occurring? Now, to say that interaction is occurring, one has to look at the content. And that is, I could be up here talking, I could see this, and you could be out there apparently listening. In other words, we have all the structure for dialogue is present. But let's say I'm talking and, you know, you're over there talking to your neighbor. In other words, you're completely disengaged, that the content of this interaction does not reflect some kind of coordinated communication. In that case, you would say, look, you're here, but you're not really engaged in it. You're not getting anything from me. Quite possible. The only way to diagnose that would be to actually monitor exactly what the content was on the sender side and the receiver side to see that the messages were being sent, but they were also being received. And perhaps, if we're lucky, we might be able to see some kind of reciprocal interaction that states that you express, content you express, let's say in a Q&A or something of that sort, was also coming back and influencing the content of my responses. So you need to look not just at the structure of the dialogue, but at the detailed content. Where is that detailed content expressed? The patterns of activity across individual cells. So Albert Lee, who was a graduate student at the time, set out to look at the structure and content of this sleep-related discharge activity in the hippocampus with this very simple experiment. So the animal sleeps in a little platform. It gets up for about 15 minutes. It runs back and forth, and then it sleeps again. Now, while the animal runs along a track like this, it activates these place cells in the sequential manner. And the idea is that as it runs back and forth along this track, it is forming memory, but it is modifying the hippocampus in a way that would increase the likelihood that these sequential patterns would be retained and expressed. So is forming memories of sequential locations. And if that were the case, we should be able to see evidence of those sequential memories during the sleep afterward. And so this was the data, the animal running back and forth, activating place cells. In a sequence here, we see 8 place cells in which the average firing, or the place feel, is indicated by these little curves, and the peak of the place feel is indicated by these ticks. So in this case, as the animal walks from left to right over a course of about 5 seconds, these place cells will be activated 1 through 8 in this order. What Albert noted was when the animal went to sleep, he saw the same cells being activated in the same order, but now over a much shorter time scale. What took the animal 5 seconds to walk through here during the awake state took the animal 150 milliseconds to express during the sleep. These are just different individual examples. And when you ask, what was this macroscopic signature, the macroscopic activity, electrical activity, the EEG, at the time at which these sequences were expressed, and he found it's these ripples. So basically, when you see these ripples, what the hippocampus is saying, the hippocampus is re-expressing sequences of previously experienced locations. Now, you could say, okay, so there are two pieces of phenomenology that I'm trying to capture. And that is, one is the expression of sequential activity during behavior. This was this theta phase precession model. It was a very simple model that said magnitude is translated into latency. Stronger means earlier. Now, this was during active behavior. But now during sleep, during these ripple events, what I didn't show you, and it depends on the recordings, but during these ripple events, there is a transient drop in inhibition. Essentially, that is what a sharp wave is. It's the medial septum, which provides primary source of cholinergic innervation, which also has GABAergic projections into the hippocampus. And for about 150 milliseconds, what happens is these GABAergic septal interneurons, inhibitory neurons, hit GABAergic neurons in the hippocampus, shut down inhibition for about 100 milliseconds. And so a sharp wave event in the hippocampus looks like a single cycle of the theta rhythm. In fact, it's the same cells. Medial septum paces the theta rhythm. It's the same interneurons that drive this rhythmic variation in inhibition. Same neurons drive this transient variation in inhibition during sharp waves. So you can ask, look, if we sweep inhibition like this during sleep, what's going to happen? So let's just provide an input into a group of hippocampal neurons, sweep inhibition, we just drop inhibition. What will happen is, as we drop inhibition, hippocampal cells that are getting stronger input will fire first. Those with weaker input will fire later. And that is, you will re-express the sequence that is captured in the static input at this location. So I can simply provide an input. The hippocampus, by sweeping inhibition, will expand that into its temporal context. So you get time and time order for free. That's what the hippocampus would be doing here. Now, if the hippocampus is doing this, and that is, it's expressing time-ordered information, the question is, where is it going, and who is listening? Now, some things to note here, and that is that these replayed events, they occur during non-REM slow-wave sleep, they seem to be compressed, and they're most robust during the period of sleep immediately following behavior. And so the question is, what's the downstream? What would be the downstream partner, the neocortical partner that I had pointed out in that in the data showing this ripple spindle correlation? What would the cortex actually be hearing? What would be doing during these replayed events? And so the idea is, we'll just record simultaneously in the hippocampus and in the neocortex, and then look for activity. Now, this was work done by a postdoc in the lab, Dion G, and what he set out to do was to identify neocortical correlates of this reactivation by recording simultaneously in primary and secondary visual cortex and in the CA1 region of the hippocampus. And he did this while an animal ran on a very simple linear maze of the sort that you saw before, with one small change, one small difference, and that is that the maze itself, most of the mazes have nondescript black surfaces. The reason we do that is, well, we like black. It's something that's uniform. It doesn't interfere with our tracking. It's just a very practical color. But if we're looking in the visual cortex, G's thinking was, perhaps we should introduce some visual cues. And so he added in these visual textures. So as the animal walks along this maze, he's walking down a corridor in which there are varying visual textures. The visual information coming to the visual cortex is changing as a function of time and location. Now, this turned out to be a really important modification to the task, because what it allowed was for G to actually create, in a sense, spatial receptive fields in the visual cortex. What G found was that when he looked at individual neurons in the visual cortex, they too would fire preferentially at certain locations along the maze. Here's an example of one visual cortical cell that would tend to fire here in this portion of the maze. Not unlike hippocampal cells, which would also fire at certain locations in the maze. Now, you might say, so the visual cortex has place cells? It's a bit of a leap to say these are place cells, because if you turn off the lights, for instance, eliminate visual stimuli, these visual cortical cells are very sensitive to that, and that is, they're responding to cues. These hippocampal place cells, on the other hand, are largely resistant to that. That is, they will continue to express what's referred to as this allocentric correlate, space out there, as opposed to simply the sensory information that correlates with space. Now, there's some question as to exactly how much of this is purely a function of space, and how much of this is in fact a consequence of memory. And this is some work that G is working on right now, but I will just give you a little hint of the fact that this is not purely a sensory correlate. And that is, if you turn off the lights, even under these conditions, these visual cortical cells will retain a diminished but nonetheless significant component of the spatial response. They continue to fire at the locations where the cues are or were, despite their actual physical absence. So there is some trace or memory of these visual sensory cues, even in these primary visual neocortical areas. Nonetheless, by putting the cues in there, what he was able to do was create, in a sense, place fields in the visual cortex. What this allowed was for him to establish sequences of visual cortical responses as the animal moved through the maze. So as the animal ran along these paths, visual cortical cells would also fire in a sequence. Purple cell would fire here, green, yellow, etc. You can try to illustrate these sequences by looking at the average receptive fields, smoothing the firing rates, just putting a little tick at the peak of those receptive fields, and then defining an order. In this case, these visual cortical cells fire, again, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Now, these are not as nice. They're not as clearly defined as the hippocampal fields that you see, which you get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, for instance. But nonetheless, there is a systematic order that you can define. And what G found was that during sleep, following this behavior, just as in the hippocampus, one sees the spatial reactivation, sequential reactivation, one could see sequential reactivation in the visual cortex. And that is, the cells would also fire in an ordered fashion. Here, you can see the averaged, this is just one event, this is just one second event in which the same cells that were active during behavior are active during sleep. You can smooth their firing rates, define an order, and then ask, is the order of activity, the sequence of activation during this 1 second period, in some way predicted by the sequence of activation that one observed during awake behavior? This is what we did in the hippocampus. This is what was done in the visual cortex. Now, this is just one event. Of course, you have to look at many of these events. But when you're looking for these events, the question is, where are these events occurring? Now, I describe the reactivation of hippocampal events as occurring during these ripples. And here we see activity, raw data in the neocortex, visual cortex, hippocampus, along with the local field potentials, or EEG, in the hippocampus and in the neocortex, in which you can see these ripple events. So this is over about 5 seconds. And what you see here is that there are these periods of these bursts. This is the and that when these bursts occur, if you look at the activity across many cells, in this case we're just looking at the unit activity across 5 cells, you notice that the activity across these cells seems to come in these periods of elevated and diminished activity. Here, there are periods of silence, there are periods of elevated activity, and that these ripples seem to occur when activity in the hippocampus is elevated. So there are these periods of about a second or so, when lots of cells in the hippocampus are active, ripples get expressed, then there are periods of silence. The same thing seems to occur in the neocortex, minus the ripples, in which there are periods of silence, followed by periods of activity, followed by periods of silence. And in the EEG, one sees that there is this rhythmic activity, these little ticks here, in fact, are a signature of the slow wave of slow wave sleep. These are the so-called K complex, which indicates the initiation of a slow oscillation, which itself is correlated, if you were to record intracellularly from neocortical cells, corresponds to a transient depolarization of individual neurons that's synchronized across the cortex. So in the cortex during slow wave sleep, neurons, individual pyramidal cells, are being transiently depolarized for about a second and then hyperpolarized. The depolarized and hyperpolarized. These are the so-called up states and down states. so that there are periods, the up state, during which the cell would be excitable, would correlate with increased multi-unit discharge. Cells would fire. The cells are hyperpolarized. Discharge goes away. They're depolarized. Activity comes back. This is indicated by the slow oscillation, the K-complex here in the EEG. And what you have is what you would normally expect during slow-wave sleep. This is activity in the neocortex during slow-wave sleep. Now, interestingly, these upstate-like periods also seem to occur in the hippocampus. You notice there are stretches of, again, stretches of activity when cells are active. But hippocampal pyramidal cells don't express intrinsic up and down states, that they don't by themselves switch between this depolarized and hyperpolarized state. Nonetheless, it appears as though they're switching between these states. So you might think, if they can't do it themselves, maybe it's being driven. Maybe they're actually simply reflecting these transient changes in the neocortical input. And in fact, the timing, relative timing of these upstate-like transitions is consistent with that. You notice that this upstate in the neocortex begins just before the hippocampus, here. Now, if you correlate the onset of these upstates in the neocortex and the hippocampus across all of the events, what you find is that an upstate in the hippocampus starts about 50 milliseconds after one in the neocortex. So, upstate starts in the cortex, 50 milliseconds later, activity increases in the hippocampus. When activity increases in the hippocampus, you get expression of these ripples. During these ripples is when you're getting expression of these sequences. In the neocortex, you're seeing these sequences, and it happens that the relative timing of sequences in the neocortex to sequences in the hippocampus is switched in the other direction. In other words, sequences in the neocortex follow the hippocampus. So neocortex starts it off. Neocortex leads the hippocampus in initiating an upstate. Hippocampus replays sequences, and then the neocortex follows in the expression of sequences. Neocortex starts it, hippocampus plays it, neocortex responds or reflects that sequence. And when you look for these events, you ask, okay, if we take all of those little upstate periods, how many of them actually contain identifiable or meaningful sequential structure? That's this number of replaying frames, as she referred to them. That is, these are periods, upstate-like periods, that contain sequences that correspond to the sequences that you see during behavior. And in red here, you see the number that were actually found. And in blue and in black are the expected distributions if, in fact, sequential activity is produced by chance alone. So there are two distributions here. One, this is this analytical distribution shown in black, which just says, look, if we were just to ask how many sequences, how many different permutations, we have 12 cells, how many different sequences could we produce? And how many would we expect? We would get something here in black. In blue, what we can do is we can say, look, I know that when the animal ran, we actually saw the sequence 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. But let's just, for the heck of it, let's look for other sequences. Maybe it just happens that that certain sequences like to be expressed, and we just got lucky and happened to hit one that is intrinsically, endogenously expressed, and there's nothing special about it relating to behavior. In other words, we're seeing the sequence not because of behavior. These sequences are just embedded there, and we just happen to detect them. So let's look for other sequences. In fact, let's look for all sequences. So if we look for all possible permutations, we do the same analysis, but instead of looking for the actual behavioral sequence, let's just look for the other possible permutations, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, for instance. And you find those here. That creates a distribution, and that's shown in blue. Not surprisingly, the blue distribution, the actual empirical distribution, and the analytical distribution, the chance distribution, tend to overlap pretty well. But you notice this in red, the number of events that correspond to the behavioral sequence are way out here. And that is, they're out about 6 standard deviations out. And that says, if you look for any sequence other than the behavioral sequence, it falls in the distribution. If you just happen to look for the sequence that the animal actually ran through, both in the visual cortex and in the hippocampus, you find it at a much greater level, at a significantly increased level relative to chance. Now, you notice I was actually pointing over here to this one to show the significant increase. Well, this is during the sleep before running in the visual cortex. The biggest effects are out here during the sleep after running. Now it's way out here, 7+ standard deviations. It's not even in the tail of the distribution. It's not in the distribution, essentially. That is, this is not a statistical event. It's not just an increased likelihood of producing a pattern like this. What this suggests is this is producing that pattern and no others. That's what it's doing. But during the sleep beforehand, there does seem to be an increased expression of these patterns before behavior. Now, this is not ESP. Animals have done this task before. In fact, they've run this repeatedly. What this suggests is that over time, with repetition, while in the hippocampus, there's a big difference between before and after, that these hippocampal reactivation events are strongly biased by recent experience. What you've just done tends to be what gets replayed during sleep. In the neocortex, on the other hand, over time, that these patterns now are expressed not just after the experience, but are available beforehand. And the idea would be, and this is pushing it, but what the heck, I mean, I'm not subject to peer review in this talk. The idea would be that the neocortex is gradually building. It is building a model. It's capturing the statistical regularity, and that is, it's incorporating in its intrinsic patterns of activity the consequences of past experience. The hippocampus just takes what's new. The neocortex reflects the consolidation of that which was old. And just to point out that what goes on in the visual cortex and what goes on in the hippocampus are in fact linked, coordinated, not just at the level of timed activity, not just ripples correlated with spindles, not just upstates correlated with upstates, but in fact the content, when the hippocampus plays back one sequence, let's say running along one path, the visual cortex is expressing the visual counterpart to that sequence. In other words, the content is correlated. So we can ask, when the hippocampus replays a pattern, let's say like this, these are two events that occur in the hippocampus and visual cortex. So when the hippocampus replays one trajectory, does the visual cortex replay the same trajectory? And so we can simply ask, how many times do we find a pairing of visual cortical and hippocampal trajectory that match? In other words, they're the same trajectory. And you find that there are a significant number of them. Now, you can also look for sequences that are expressed for the different trajectories, hippocampus doing one, visual cortex doing another. They're both viable sequences. They both happen to be expressed during reactivation. But the question is, how often do they get activated together? How often does the hippocampus run through one sequence and the visual cortex is just doing another one? They're doing two completely separate, independent reactivation events. And the answer is that they don't do that. That's no better than chance. So what you find is when reactivation occurs, it occurs in a coordinated manner, coordinated in time, coordinated in content. So what we see is that these kinds of interactions, these sleep-related ripple interactions, reactivation in the hippocampus, coordinated with reactivation in the visual cortex, occurs during these well-structured periods of slow-wave sleep. So you just imagine the sleep, the brain is kind of going up and down, soothing, almost put you to sleep, or up and down. Right? And during this, there's this hippocampus is doing stuff, neocortex is doing stuff, that it's allowed to carry on this kind of dialogue uninterrupted because it's cut off from the outside world. But, as I pointed out, in the hippocampus, these ripple events are not restricted to sleep. They occur when the animal is just sitting quietly. So, the hippocampus, very opportunistic, during active behavior, when it needs to actually guide behavior or take in new information while the animal's moving, the activity is modulated by this theta rhythm. But as soon as the animal stops, you get these ripple discharges back again. It's like the hippocampus can go to sleep at the drop of a pin. Just go to sleep. If it's not actively engaged in interacting with the environment, just say, forget it. I've got better stuff to do. I'm going to start working on something. So we can ask, is reactivation going on when an animal is just sitting quietly? Now, this quiet wakeful period, it does not mean that the animal has to be stationary. The animal can be engaged in behavior. So there are many behaviors, such as feeding, such as grooming, such as copulation. All of these things are indicated by presence of this quiet, wakeful, inactivated state. In other words, you don't have to think about what you're doing. You just do it. So-called consummatory states. You satisfying internal states, like automatic behavior. And so we can ask, what goes on during this kind of automatic behavior, in which we see these ripple oscillations? Is there reactivation going on during these states? And this is a question that Dave Foster in the lab, postdoc in the lab, took on. And he actually wasn't doing this experiment. We never did any experiment to look at quiet wakeful reactivation. The animals just do this. This is something that they normally do. What David did was he allowed the animals to do what rats normally do. So I'll have to confess, this experiment has been done thousands of times by researchers studying place cells. There's nothing clever about this experiment. Have the animals running back and forth on tracks. But if you're an astute observer of animal behavior, you notice that the first time you put an animal in an environment on a track like this, here's what it will do. It will walk over, you put it on here, it might walk to the end, find some food, eat it, and sit there. Animals do a lot of sitting around. Normally. Now, the data that I show you, the place cell data, generally comes from animals that have been trained or pre-trained or encouraged or in some way coaxed to express running behavior, to move, under the belief that somehow the interesting stuff in the hippocampus goes on when the animals are actually moving. That if you're sitting there doing nothing, then you are, in a literal sense, doing nothing. There's nothing of functional interest. And so we would tend to pre-select animals and behavior and data, which in fact did not include periods of sitting around, so-called the slacker rat data. It's not interesting. The animal's not doing anything. So what Dave did really was simply allow the animal to sit, to do what it normally does during novel exposure or first exposure to an environment, and then ask, is there anything interesting in the data at that time? And so, again, the same experiment you've seen before. In this case, there are 19 place cells that are going to be activated at different locations, relative positions along the track. So as the animal walks from left to right, these place cells will be activated in order 1 to 19. And we're just going to ask, what happens when the animal stops? What goes on in the pattern activity in the hippocampus? You can say, what does he think about? And this is the raw data. This is now from a single trial. This is the first time the animal is put on the track. Over time here, we're looking at a couple of minutes of data. And as the animal walks from left to right, as the position changes from here to there, then the animal stops. Now, while the animal is walking from left to right, running, you can see these place cells that are active. First place cell 1, and then last place cell 19. This is the order. This is the running order. Now, you know it's kind of variable. This is this behavioral time scale that I was talking about. When the animal stops, you see the expression of these little, what appear to be synchronous discharges, lots of spikes occurring over a short period of time. If we expand one of those, you can see that these little bursts are, in fact, one of these hippocampal ripple, sharp wave ripple events, this and that during one of these ripple events, cells are active, place cells are active, and they're active in a sequential manner. In other words, they re-express the sequential structure of place cell activation, recent place cell activation. But in this case, they're reactivating that order in time reverse fashion. In other words, it starts at place cell 19 and runs back to place cell 1, backward in time. And that's just one event. But if we look at all the events, so this is, we just take each of those individual events here. So you can see here, I just pulled out one. But if we just take all of these things, take all of them. You see that in each and every one of these, it's just repeatedly running backward in time. So it's replaying on each one of these bursts, replaying this reverse sequence. Now, why would you want to do this? What would possibly be the utility of this kind of reverse sequence activation? Well, it just turns out that Dave Foster before coming to work in the lab, had worked with Peter Diane, who was a computational neuroscientist, and had been interested in the problem of unsupervised or reinforced spatial navigation learning. The question is, how does an animal learn where things are in space? How does it learn to navigate in space when you don't give it any explicit instruction, but rather you simply reinforce it when it has reached a goal? And the problem in general machine learning is known as the temporal credit assignment problem. The animal's wandering along, it encounters unexpected reward, and you want the animal to learn not simply where the reward is, but you want to learn what led up to it. You want to reinforce the positions and the state that preceded it so that you can use that to predict or guide future behavior. So that when I'm placed here, I can say, ah, that reward is up ahead. I will follow this gradient up to the reward point. Use it to predict behavior. And one strategy for doing that, there are many iterative algorithms for doing that, but there is one quick and dirty way of solving this in one shot, and that has to do with replaying sequences in reverse time order. This is just in machine learning. If you want to accelerate the process of reinforcement learning and solve the temporal credit assignment problem, one thing that you do is just introduce this reverse time order evaluation step. And the idea is this. The animal runs to the end, he stops, and at this point, you deliver reinforcement, let's say dopamine, in a form like this. That is an increase with some kind of decay. And at the same time, you replay the sequence in reverse. And then you pair these two such that now the current location is paired with with maximal reinforcement, the highest dopamine signal. The furthest location is paired with the weakest signal. So that doing this, pairing reverse sequence reactivation with a reinforcement signal like this, essentially convolves this event with an exponential and goes from this to this in one step, solves the temporal credit assignment problem one step. Now, does this actually occur? We've recently been doing experiments recording simultaneously in the VTA and in the hippocampus. And while I would like to put the data up here to show you in a compelling way that this, in fact, does happen, the data we have now is preliminary, but the preliminary data is strikingly consistent with this simple scenario, that in fact dopamine neuron discharge in the VTA is correlated with and time-locked with hippocampal ripples, and that there are indications that the time course of a more complicated signal. Dopamine itself does not seem to be modulated in this way, but the output of the VTA does seem, in fact, to carry this kind of time-modulated signature, and that this cartoon does, in fact, seem to be borne out in the actual physiology. But you'll have to invite me back another time for me to show you the actual data. So we have this simple scenario in which unsupervised learning, something that is generically useful, it's so generically useful that right now there are people out on Wall Street making millions of dollars doing basically what this rat is doing, and that is simply doing this kind of unsupervised learning, trying to predict trends based on nothing more than immediate returns, reinforcement, using these kind of machine learning algorithms to make predictions. And so this process is not something that would be unique to spatial learning, not something that would be unique even necessarily to the hippocampus. It would be a general property of rapid, unsupervised learning. Now, back to this simple model. I like to harp on this because, you know, you might think I've talked about a couple of things. This phase precession, sequence encoding during behavior and the theta rhythm, the reactivation of sequences, forward sequences during sleep, and now we have this reverse sequence reactivation during quiet wakeful states. And a simple model, I've offered a single simple model to try to explain at least the phenomenology up to this point. Now you might ask, how do you explain reverse reactivation? Well, it turns out you can use exactly the same model. The same model not only explains, but in fact predicts this kind of reverse reactivation. And the idea is this. Again, the model is just magnitude to latency. Stronger means earlier. Stronger input, fire earlier if you sweep inhibition. So if we imagine that we have these place cells, here shown here, the above the iceberg effect, right above the waterline, above threshold responses shown here in filled in the light blue. And then we imagine that we have three of these place cells one after the other, one, two, three. Now, the simple model that I described to you before involved sweeping inhibition here on the leading edge where the gradient of excitation was positive. And in that case, the order is 1, 2, 3. Place cell 1 has a stronger input than 2, than 3. If we do the same thing on the negative gradient region of these receptive fields, the order is reversed. Place cell 1 has a stronger input than place cell 2, than place cell 3. So sweeping inhibition here at the end of the track actually leads to reverse sequence reactivation. So you can get forward or reverse, depends on the underlying structure of these receptive fields. Now, let me just, so we have these two things, forward and reverse. I'd like to show you a movie here, which expands that. PowerPoint apparently feels I'm in danger of losing my presentation. I would like to, here we go, sort of illustrate these replay phenomena by using an approach that translates patterned activity in the hippocampus into the reconstruction or estimated behavioral state and location that produce that pattern. In other words, we're going to try to guess the meaning or reconstruct the meaning of these patterns by mapping place cell activity back into the places on the track that produced it. And so what you're seeing here, this is just a... Maybe I can get this down here. In red, so what you have, the rat is just walking along the track. We're recording place cells. Now, given the patterns of place cell activity, we're estimating the location. What is the most likely location that would have produced that pattern of place cell activity? And so we estimate or reconstruct the location as the red dot. So the red dot, when the animal is moving, basically tells us where the animal is. They're place cells. That's what place cells do. They, in fact, correlate with current location. And so you'll see the current location, the animal here, as the animal walks, it fires where the animal is. Now the animal's going to stop. And the question is, what goes on when the animal stops? We're going to do the same thing. So we're going to do the same thing. That is, reconstruct the position. Try to reconstruct the location of the animal. But the animal's not moving anymore. It's just sitting quietly. And this is slowed down. So I've slowed this down by a factor of 4. So the animal's just sitting here. And now you can see it here. Okay, these are these ripple events. So you see one of these ripples. And every time we get a ripple, just watch to see where the reconstructed position goes. Here comes a ripple. It runs back. It's sitting. Here comes another ripple. Runs back. Here's another one. Runs back. So this is the raw data. I mean, this is all the data you've seen. I haven't just pulled out individual events. That is, you know, about 5 seconds of the animal just sitting there. You see this kind of repeated reverse traversal. But now this is on a simple maze where the animal just runs to the end and stops. But what about a longer maze, a more complicated one, where the animal stops not at locations of reinforcement, but at some intermediate location? And what we'll see here is that now we can in fact see both forward and reverse. And in this maze, so here you can see this is a serpentine maze. It's very long. And the animal's going to walk along, and now it's going to stop. It's going to stop at positions, no reinforcement. It's just stopping because it feels like stopping. And so we can ask, what are these events? What are the reconstructed events that we can see? And you may have noticed that you see events that have both a forward and a reverse structure. I'll just run it again, and I'll slow this down. So this is in real time. The animal's just walking. Now, while it's walking, you see this reconstructs to his current location. That's just place cells. Now he stops, and now you start to see these things running forward along the track. There's a short forward. You see some of them that will actually run in reverse, starting at distant locations. And if I just show up, if I just expand one of those, again, I'm going to slow this down. And you're going to see a complex event that actually starts at current location, runs all the way along the track. And so this is the animal thinking about, I don't know what it's thinking about, but I do know what its hippocampus is actually expressing. And that is, it is expressing the state or location, sequential location information that corresponds to sequences that have been and potentially could be expressed. The animal's thinking about what it's actually going to do. Now, if we put the animal on a T maze, I don't have that movie here, but if you have it on a maze where it can make a choice, what you see is that the sequences will follow the potential paths. It will run along the right arm, run along the left arm, and that the hippocampus is simply expressing sequential states, sequential experiences that that might be relevant for the given task.
It starts moving again. Where is it in the maze? Where is it? When the animal starts moving again, where?
So as soon as the animal starts moving again, now you switch back into the theta mode, and the theta expresses the current location. So as soon as the hippocampus is offline, you can think about other things. As soon as the animal starts to move and the theta comes back, it's now driven by the current state. Hippocampus could be anywhere, that's right. It could be replaying things off in the other part of the maze. As soon as the animal starts up again, it locks back into the current location. So, to end, so we can see that we have these replay events. And they're very frequent, they're very robust. I'm to the point where I can show you, just the real-time data. This is what the animal is actually thinking about at any given time. And it suggests, although again, the data demonstrating that this is really related to learning is yet to come, but it suggests that there is this kind of offline processing related to reinforcement learning that's going on all the time. And for me, not only is it important that these things manifest themselves, but I think the fact that they manifest themselves in a way that can potentially be explained by very simple intrinsic biophysical properties. Everything that I've described, everything that I've shown you, can be explained by the simplest of biophysical models. It does not include complex dynamic recurrent networks. It doesn't include anything, in fact, beyond these simple feed-forward connections within the hippocampus. Because of that, what it means is the same model could be applied anywhere in the brain. This is not exclusive to the hippocampus. The same kind of process could be going on in the hippocampus, could be going on in the visual cortex, could be going on in the prefrontal cortex. That this ability to translate, to encode, to re-express sequential information may very well just be an intrinsic property of networks throughout the brain, and that these networks are engaged in some functionally meaningful way during sleep. So I just want to thank the people in the lab, Mike Mehta, who did the early work on asymmetry, which I personally have found very influential in my thinking. It's a simple model, but nonetheless, I think it's very deep and explains a lot. Albert Lee, who just started at Genelia Farm, doing this work on non-REM sequential reactivation, demonstrating for the first time the structure of these sequential reactivation events. Then Dave Foster, who did the work, the slacker rat work, just letting the rat sit, and then letting it show us what it was actually thinking about. And then more recently, Diane G, who did the work on the hippocampus and visual cortex, which really gave us the ability to interrogate the dialogue, or potential dialogue, that goes on between the hippocampus and neocortex during sleep. And G, as we call him, is the only one without a parenthetic notation. That's because he's out there looking for a job. So I want to thank you. Sorry, if you could speak up. Ah, right. So the question is, you know, how can you guarantee, basically, how can you guarantee that when we see these sequences, that they really correspond to sequences, let's say, in this context and not in some other context, that maybe you're thinking about, you know, running down another hall, and you just happen to map it into this hall. Well, this is the beauty of the hippocampus and the place cell phenomenology, and that is, if I take the same maze and I put it into a different place, a different room, the context itself remaps, as it's referred to, the patterns, so that you get different patterns in different rooms, different contexts, different environments, so that the patterns that you do see are unique to a given maze, in a given room, in a given rat, in a given task. If I change any of those, I will change the pattern. So they become a unique signature of the singular experience and events that go on under some kind of identified condition. So we could tell the patterns in another room would be different. They would be different patterns of cells, and they would be in a different sequence. Right. Yes, the reward issue. Yeah, that's something that we're looking at right now, and it's unclear what the requirement for reward, although in the simple little movie that I showed you there, and this is work that we're writing up right now, and that is that it does appear that there is some bias, perhaps, to forward reactivation, the absence of reward, reverse reactivation, the presence of reward, and there was a recent publication at Yuri Busaki's lab, in which he fortunately was able to confirm and could reproduce both the reverse reactivation and the forward reactivation events during quiet wakefulness. And he came to a similar conclusion, and that is that there does seem to be the ability to express both, and it may be influenced by reinforcement. Now, there's a simple variation to that model. We can talk about it perhaps later, in which you simply vary, the idea is that you can select forward and reverse by simply changing slightly the rules that have to do with activity-dependent relative excitability. And that is, if you increase or decrease relative excitability based upon recent activity, you can bias activity in forward or reverse. So the idea is this: you can dump in dopamine as you're running along. If you now modify biophysically excitability such that recently activated cells are going to be preferentially activated, that gives you a reverse. If you suppress that activity, then it gives you forward. So you actually can steer the reactivation simply by varying the rules for activity-dependent excitability, which, of course, it's very easily accomplished. So, yes, the question, have I contemplated manipulating patterns, manipulating memory? I've been doing more than contemplating. I've been trying to do this desperately for about a decade. It just turns out to be really, really hard. Although, you know, with some of the later, the more recent developments and these optogenetic techniques for gaining very high precision control, you know, the channel rhodopsin, halo rhodopsin, methods that I'm sure each and every one of you is probably considered and perhaps using right at this moment. But, you know, these approaches for manipulating activity absolutely are essential. As I tell people in the lab, these are not just interesting or important experiments to do. These are imperatives. These are empirical imperatives. Until we can demonstrate that these things actually make a difference by gaining control, by manipulating the structure, then they're just interesting behavioral correlates. So it's going to happen. I mean, it's maybe another decade, but yeah, absolutely.
I have a question about the visual responses that you showed. They look, as you pointed out, more sloppy than
right.
The place cell activity. Is that correlated at all with how the animal moves the task?
Yeah. So those, you know, in a sense, there's no reason that we should have gotten these spatial receptive fields at all. Because if you think about it, we just put textures into the maze. I mean, we didn't, You know, we didn't design them any way to drive particular cells. They're not controlled for, position in the receptive field, for, optimal orientation. They simply happen to have a property of spatial continuity, which in some way seems to selectively engage certain cells. So the idea is that when you activate large populations of these visual cortical cells during normal behavior, they tend to select themselves out in a way that you could say maximizes this orthogonality. They try to create patterns that are separate so that you don't have the same visual cortical response at different locations in the maze, even if there are similar textures. And there are. In fact, these textures are not unique. It's not like there's a unique pattern at every location in the track. There are just half a dozen of them that are repeated. And so it has to be something involving the sequential juxtaposition of these patterns that confers some kind of specificity. So could they be improved? Probably. They could probably be improved if you were to try to optimize the patterns. But I think that they probably just naturally arise as a consequence of motion, that motion through space contributes some source of input to these sensory areas that adds a spatial component. That was basically the hypothesis that we had, and it did seem to be the case that the spatial correlate was added on top of the visual stimuli.
So in sleep, do you find the same thing?
The reverse replay. So, we don't know about that. The reverse replay. Although there's some interesting things that we've been doing, that you could say we have sensory cortical activation, reactivation during sleep, and you have the same spontaneous events going on in the hippocampus. But what about during quiet wakefulness? So in quiet wakefulness, you have the hippocampus that's thinking about other locations, but you have the visual cortex that nonetheless is still being driven by current sensory stimuli. One hypothesis is that if you were to alter the gain, the relative balance, you could drive sensory cortex during awake behavior in the same way that you do during sleep, and that would create a perceptual anomaly which you might call hallucination, for instance. And so the idea is that there is this continuous balance that, in fact, it has some kind of functional significance, that even during awake behavior, the hippocampus, in a sense, through this reactivation, is filling in, that is, it's providing some bias to normal sensory-driven perceptual activity, which is functionally meaningful. But if you alter that is, you drive it too hard from the inside out, that you can, you can overwhelm these sensory areas and produce anomalous percepts. So we don't know that occurs. It doesn't seem to occur. We've looked at that data during normal behavior, but perhaps under the influence of certain psychotropic drugs or other conditions in which one expresses anomalous kind of perceptual hallucinations, we're looking to see whether that might occur. The synchronization between the two. I have to confess that all of these experiments we do, where they're lateralized, we look in the right hemisphere. Why don't we look at multiple hemispheres? It's not because it's not interesting, it's just a little technically more difficult. I have a postdoc right now who's looking at the synchronization of reactivation events across the two hippocampal hemispheres. Now, it is the case that these ripple events tend to be only loosely correlated, if at all, between the two, so that the reactivation seems to be able to go on apparently independently, in the two. But that doesn't mean that the content is necessarily independent. So you could have the same content, but be expressing it at slightly different times, for instance. We just don't know the answer to that yet.
The mean frequency, say the theta, can be modulated. And I think if you modulate the higher frequency, it is mapped to a higher spatial resolution when you go to the plate. So it suggests that frequency modulation also has a spatial remapping.
Yeah, so the question is there a relationship between, let's say, theta frequency and spatial resolution? There is a correlate of running speed, and that is that the frequency does change as the animals actually increase speed. Although it's not a simple velocity correlate. You could think of this, there's a lot of variation in theta frequency that goes on, you know, even during sort of apparently stationary behavior. Animals just running, a lot of fluctuation in theta. I think that the frequency, the question of theta frequency, it's not simply about compressing or, you know, increasing the resolution, but that in some other work that I didn't talk about where we looked at the coherence of the theta rhythm as expressed in the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex, that what you have is that there are multiple theta rhythms across the brain. And when the animal is actually engaged in a task where it needs to use spatial information, in other words, make a decision, a spatial working memory task, that the theta rhythm in the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex lock. That is, they become coherent. But they become coherent in a way in which the variation in theta frequency is, in fact, important. So you can think about, there's the simple model, the radio tuner model. As like right now, I've got, you know, there are, you know, 30 different stations broadcasting. There's information that's flowing through the air. And if I wanted to selectively tune into it, one thing I could do is I could pick a frequency, I lock to it, I phase lock to it, and now suddenly I have a channel into that and I can selectively listen to, respond to that channel. If I want to listen to something else, I switch the channel. So you can use that, this kind of, you know, the radio metaphor in the brain. You say, look, if I have different brain areas that want to listen to other brain areas, one thing they could do is like switch stations. The thing is, station switching in the brain is not accomplished through selection of different frequency bands. These frequency bands, they're biophysically constrained. You know, theta is, there are reasons that you have theta. So you can think about how could you actually achieve this kind of switching, station switching. And I believe that the way in which this is done is through adaptive frequency modulation. What you actually have is you have a frequency signature that varies. And if you track that frequency signature, frequency modulation, now you can lock. You can lock on a fixed carrier. You can lock to different sources. And so this variation in frequency is not simply being used to, you know, to compress or change the time scale, but it's actually being used to direct this information to different targets. It's being used simultaneously for encoding of these sequences as well as the coherence or communication with selected targets. That's the simple answer.